Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley. I'm your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. This is a show about all of that, and I'm so happy because David Steinberg is back with us, and he is the author of This Thing We Call Sex. And he knows that sex is who we are, how we live, and how we experience desire, yearning, joy, and life. His book is a wonderful book. We spoke about it a little bit, quite a lot, actually, on his last time here, which was April the 14th. Welcome once again to this program, David Steinberg.
Thanks, Diana. Good to be talking with you.
It's just, you know, you are so knowledgeable and articulate and so a perfect guest for this program, Love, Lust, and Laughter. And so our focus for this program is going to be on monogamy and the myths around it and so on, and also on erotic images and David's photography. So, your book, you review so many things in your book, and we talked last time, people can go to the archives for the last show, April the 14th, and hear that program. And but we're going to cover more this time, and monogamy. I want to start with a quote from Oscar Wilde. He famously said, "Marriage is the triumph of imagination over intelligence." And perhaps it's not marriage per se that suggests, not so much intelligence, but the nearly universal expectation that a happy couple will forsake all others for the rest of their lives. Can you comment on that, David?
Well, that is what monogamy talks about, you know, and most societies are monogamous. I think it's one thing to say if you make that choice that you want to limit your sexual activity to your spouse, to your wife or husband, and certainly many people, maybe most people, feel like that's what they want to do. The question for me, which I raise in this chapter of the book from This Thing We Call Sex, is the notion that once you're engaged with somebody, once you're married, that you won't have any desire to have sexual connections with other people, that you won't be attracted to other people in a sexual way. And that's the part that I think gets people in trouble and is just unrealistic. It's one thing to say, sure, I may be attracted to other people, but I'm not going to act on that. It's another thing to say, I will not or I should not be attracted to any other people in the first place. And I think, especially in a society like ours, where people have all sorts of opportunity to have interactions at various levels with lots of other people, it's really unrealistic to think that we're not going to have attractions to other people, and therefore to have to figure out how do we want to deal with that within a marriage relationship.
Christopher Ryan, who wrote Sex at Dawn, he said something interesting. He said our notions of death to us part, that kind of bliss, demand that we confuse love and lust, even though the two are as distinctly different as red wine and blue cheese.
Right.
And he goes on to say that love is like a farmer tilling the soil, planning for future harvests, But lust is an explorer, a wanderer, an outlaw. No wonder the Spanish word esposas means both wives and handcuffs. Did you know that?
Oh, that's interesting. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So, yeah, he's, of course, with Sex at Dawn. It's a brilliant book, and he looks at all of these aspects of monogamy and from an evolutionary point of view. And you do, too. You touch on that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, as with so many things about sexuality, I think where we get ourselves in trouble is by not acknowledging and respecting what we feel or what we're likely to feel, and to be very quick to say, if I think this, if I want that, if I experience this, it means that something's wrong with me. It means I'm a bad person. It means I'm betraying somebody or not acting in a proper way. Because the rules that we're given about sex are so narrow, anytime we have thoughts that fall outside those rules, we end up thinking that there's something wrong with us instead of that there's something wrong with the rules. And I think once we start feeling bad about our natural sexual feelings, then we're at war with ourselves. And being at war with yourself in that kind of way is a recipe for emotional disaster, I think. You know, now personally, in my life, I have been in a number of long-term relationships. I'm 70 years old. I've been, you know, in relationships since I was 21. My first relationship, when we were married, we planned to be monogamous. Shortly thereafter, a year or two after we'd been married, I was on a business trip and I was very much attracted to somebody else. Fortunately, by that time, my wife and I had you know, sat down and talked about this and said, look, it's likely that we're going to be attracted to other people. What are we going to do when that happens?
Mm-hmm.
And so we agreed to open up our relationship and not restrict our sexual activity to being with each other. And in all the subsequent relationships that I personally have had, I have been very clear that I was not interested in being monogamous.
Mm-hmm.
So I would make that clear to, you know, anybody that I was getting close to, getting attached to, getting into a relationship with. The difficulty that we face is that if we don't admit those feelings, if we think those feelings are bad, if we try to squash them, more often than not, statistically more often than not, what happens is we act on them anyway, and then we're in a quandary because now we weren't supposed to do that, but here we have done that, and this can be for men and for women. I mean, statistically, I think still more men than women have who are married have relationships with other people, you know, outside of their primary relationship. But this is true for many women as well as for most men. So then you're in a situation where something has happened for whatever reason. Yeah, you went ahead and acted on it. And now what do you do with that with your partner? You can tell him or her what happened. Of course, people are afraid that their partners will be upset if they do that. You can not tell them. You can lie about it. You can keep it a secret. But any way you play, you know, any decisions you make about what strategy you want to have about that, is complicated. And the reason it's complicated is because the situation that was set up in the first place was a difficult one, you know, to say, I will not act on my sexual desire, or for some people, I will not have any sexual desire. I mean, for some people to just say, you know, gee, there's this person I'm working with and I'm really attracted to her, and no, I'm not going to act on it, but I want to just tell you that because you're my partner and I want to be honest with you. For a lot of people, that in itself is enough to create a crisis. What do you mean you're attracted to somebody else? You should only be attracted to me. So when we're dealing with situations that we set up an unrealistic way, we end up in quandaries that end up blowing marriages apart and relationships apart. Now, personally, I'm really glad to have seen that early in my life and been able to structure my relationships so that I don't have to be dishonest, because what's really killing to all relationships, and I believe this is true. I mean, I don't even have a morality about lying. I was taught that there are times when lying is the proper thing to do. It's you don't want your grandmother to worry about somebody having cancer, so you don't tell her, and if she says how are you, you say you're fine, because you don't want to worry her or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
My concern about being dishonest or even secretive without actually lying to a partner is that it puts energy into a relationship that I think destroys the relationship, or destroys the possibility of real intimacy in the relationship. If you're carrying a secret, you can't be open with your partner in the same way as you can if you don't have to think twice about what you're saying all the time for fear that you're going to give away your secret. So when I have friends who talk to me, and because I write about sexuality, people do that a lot. And what should I do? I'm attracted to this person, and I don't know what to do with it. I'll say, well, you can act on that if you want. You can not tell your partner if you want, but don't think you can do that without it having a huge effect on your relationship. And I think that the negative effects of that, are unavoidable. So what do we do? I think that the way to avoid that situation is to think clearly and honestly about who we are, what we feel, what we're likely to feel in the future. Be able to be open with our partners about that. Talk about it to where one person does not have to feel betrayed by the other if something like that happens.
And David Steinberg, listeners, is very wise about this. He's been writing about sex and gender since 1989, and his monthly Comes Naturally columns appeared in Spectator magazine from 1992 through 2004, and then it was online until 2006. And the second part of this program, we're going to talk about his erotic photography, because since 1999, he's photographed over 160 couples being sexual at home, as well as a series of portraits of transsexual women and participants in public disgrace filmings of kink.com. So I'm going to ask him about that a little bit more in the second half of the program. You were up here recently for the Seattle Erotic Art Festival, and you were here also in 2011. Well, you've been here, I think, several years in a row, but you were named Master of Erotic Art by the Seattle Erotic Art Festival in 2011. So I meant to say all of this in the introduction for you, but I didn't, and I wanted to back up and do that, because David Steinberg knows of which he talks, and he's had a lot of hands-on experience, writing experience. He's a smart guy. He listens well, and so, talking about monogamy, there are certainly some myths about monogamy, and I just wanted to run a myth or two by you and get your response to it. People in open relationships have psychological problems. So there's actually been some research about this, and turns out that open relationships require pretty well-developed relationship skills. And so people in them tend to have more self-awareness, better communication skills, and a better sense of self. Can you respond to that?
Well, I think, you know, I mean, being as how the culture teaches us that we're not supposed to have open relationships, that our relationships are supposed to be monogamous, I think it does take a certain amount of self-awareness for anybody to say, I'm going to not do what everybody's telling me to do, and I'm going to invent my life in my own way that's outside what is the accepted norm. You know, you have to be willing for other people to disapprove of you, for one thing, and I think it takes a certain strength of character to do anything that, that you think people around you are going to disapprove of. So, you know, so I think that's the case. I mean, when you're talking about open relationships, I think you're talking about relationships that are defined as being open, where partners agree that they're going to do this, as opposed to, I hate to call it cheating, but, you know, to extracurricular affairs where the relationship is not defined that way, which is the American norm. More people end up being sexual with somebody other than their partners than don't. So we can think that the norm is people being monogamous, but it's not. The norm is people promising to be monogamous and then breaking those promises. So, you know, now whether the people, so in an open relationship where you think about that ahead of time, I mean, I think it takes a certain amount of self-awareness to be able to know that this is something I'm going to face in my life, and so I want to address it consciously.
There's another myth that absolutely plays into what you've just described, and that is that non-monogamy is no different from cheating. And so actually cheating involves lying, deception, breaking a commitment previously made. And
right.
When there is a more open relationship, consensual non-monogamy, that is, all parties involved have agreed to the arrangement. So it's the opposite of lying, deception, and breaking a commitment.
Right, right. And I got into this in the chapter in my book, in the chapter from this thing we call sex,
yes.
where I'm talking about what I call the myths of monogamy. The way I got into that was that this was written in the 1990s, I think, and there was an Air Force captain, I think she was, Kelly Flynn, who was basically thrown out of the military because
yes.
It was discovered that she was having an affair, I believe, with her commanding officer. And and the argument went that because she had done this, she was unfit to fly planes in the Air Force. And so, you know, so this perpetuated the notion that a person who has an affair is somehow a less honorable human being, a less capable human being than somebody who does not.
And, I liked that in your book. I liked so much of your book. Let's just pause for a moment and tell people how they might get it. So it's David Steinberg, This Thing We Call Sex, and the subtitle is A Radically Sensible Look at Sex in America. So the best ways for people to get this book is?
Well, they can two ways. They can get it from Amazon, and they can get it from me, as well as my other books. My website is davidsteinberg.us. And on the website, there's the section of the website for ordering books. I have this book. I have the book
yes.
Erotic by Nature, which was my first book that I published of erotic photography and fiction. I have Photosex, which is the collection of fine art sexual photography that I put together, some of my own photos, but also photos from a number of other photographers. There's Divas of San Francisco, which is a book of my portraits of transsexual women. What else is there? Then there's The Erotic Impulse, which is a collection of writings on eroticism that I put together for Tarcher Putnam back in 1992. And all of those are available both on Amazon and from me at my website.
And if they go to your website and somebody orders, will you sign the book for them?
Oh, of course. You know, that's it. You can get the books. I think they're probably all discounted. At Amazon, you can get them for a couple of dollars cheaper at Amazon if you want to go that way, which is fine with me. Or if you want to get a personally signed copy, you can order it from me. So
I go back a long time with David Steinberg. I remember buying his Erotic by Nature in 1988 when I was in Palo Alto. And he was still in San Francisco, and I just love that book. It just touched me so much. 1988, and then about 4 years ago, I ordered a copy from you for my fiance Brian, and he's also enjoyed it too. So we're David Steinberg fans for sure.
Well, thanks. Yeah, that was my first venture into erotic publishing. I mean, there were a number of us who were critical of commercial pornography use, sort of from a feminist point of view, but we decided that if we weren't happy with pornography, then didn't it fall on our shoulders to come up with something that was a good alternative? We believed that, you know, pornography was the only sexual imagery going around, and if we had, you know, critiques of that, well, why don't we come up with some sexual imagery of our own? And Erotic by Nature was our first attempt to do that, and we spent 5 years gathering material.
5 years
for that, yeah. And not all of that is sexual material. A lot of it is what I would call sensual or erotic material,
and some poetry thrown in.
And some poetry and stories, exactly.
And stories. It's wonderful.
Yeah. And then later, Photosex is a book that is specifically sexual photography, what I call fine art sexual photography. I had met by that time dozens of photographers that were photographing sex from a fine art point of view as opposed to a pornographic point of view. And most of those photographers did not have anywhere to go with their photography. So we decided to put a book together that would showcase their work. And it was sort of through that whole network that I got involved in doing fine art sexual photography myself.
And you start your chapter in your, I love your book, this thing we call sex. So it is chapter, whatever, Real Sex in Front of a Camera.
Uh-huh.
And you said, I've always thought of myself as a word person. I love words, I love language, and so on. But I've also been fascinated by the visual world. And so, you said, I have seen photos, on the other hand, that go right to the subtleties and power of sexual connection. And you thought it would be great to go into that world more. And you've already described Erotic by Nature, which, by the way, I see in your book, it's sold over 12,000 copies to date, maybe even more by now, which is pretty respectable for a run of any art book. And you didn't even have that much money to market the thing, and still it's consistently sold over the years.
Yeah, it was really encouraging. We didn't have any, you know, it was a tiny publisher with no budget. Mm-hmm. The book sells for $45, and yet it's sold now 13,000 copies, which demonstrated to me that people do want to see erotic material that is of a whole different flavor than commercial pornography. And Photosex has not been as widely distributed, mostly because the publisher went out of business, so it only had an initial printing of 5,000 copies, but it sold it sold those copies out. I think there's a few copies left that you can still get on Amazon. Mm. But the Photosex demonstrated the same thing. People are interested. Some people are interested in sexual photography that comes from a fine art point of view, and that's what's fascinating to me. You know, photography that has emotion in it, that is not about fantasy, that's not about giving people images to masturbate to, but is trying mm-hmm. to say something about sex as the sex journalist A.D. Coleman said so brilliantly to me at one point when we were talking about this book. And I asked him, you know, what do you think makes a quality fine art sex mm-hmm. photograph? And he said, a photograph that's got something more to say than, oh, look, sex is happening and we get to watch. It's like...
Yeah, you put that in your book. I like that.
I love that because it was just... Alan, A.D. Coleman is so brilliant about these things. But and he, fortunately, he wrote the foreword to Photosex, and I was honored to have him do that.
Of course.
But, you know, these are... Any art photograph, I would say, has some or any art for that matter. The artist, the photographer, has something to say, has a point of view. So what? And you know, when I do my sexual photography, I have my point of view. I have what is important to me about sexuality. What I think is exciting, and I don't necessarily mean exciting as a sexual turn on, but is. Thought-provoking, heart-provoking about sexuality. And when I see that going on in a couple that I'm photographing, when I see the intimacy of the connection between people or something, that's what motivates me, you know, to push the button and take the picture. And so when I'm playing the role of photographer, I'm essentially expressing my view of sexuality through the work that I'm doing with the people I'm photographing. Another sexual photographer will have a different point of view about sexuality, and he or she will photograph what interests them. But the point is that the photographer does have a point of view, and for people who want to say something meaningful about sex, not to say that fantasy isn't meaningful, but, you know, something beyond fantasy material about sex. That's what fine art sexual photography is all about, and it's been just a fascinating journey for me. I started it as just an experiment. I was the photo agent for this magazine in Norway, Cupido Magazine, soliciting photographs for them, and I was meeting all of these photographers that were doing this work, and I just got fascinated with... How do you go about taking an artistic picture of people being sexual? I mean,
mm-hmm.
you know, if I'm going to photograph you, Diana, if I photograph you and your partner, and I want to somehow get on film who you are in the act of being sexual, that's not staged, that's not false, that's not, you know, caricatured in some way. How do I do that? Well. Obviously, I mean, you know, there are many people who would never have a third person around when they're being sexual anyway. So, first of all, you have to be with people who are intrigued with the idea of being photographed while being sexual. And then
sure, they have to be a little bit exhibitionistic.
Or, yes, or at least enough to have me be there. And,
yeah, I want to interrupt you because I'm fascinated by the sentence in your book. I was less interested in the anatomy of what was happening, who was doing what to whom, who was putting what where, than I was in the emotional connection going on inches in front of my watchful eyes. And you started all of this in 1999.
Right.
Because
right.
of your fascination with the visual aspects of sexuality.
Well, I was just curious. I just wanted to know, how does this work? You know, what is
yes.
this little relationship bubble that happens during a photo shoot between a couple and a photographer when they are theoretically being being themselves, being genuine about who they are, and yet there's this third person and a camera and the lights and all the paraphernalia present as part of the scene. How can you do that without distorting the situation so much that what you're photographing is not real? And for me, the way that you do that is for people to essentially be completely comfortable with me as a person, and with the situation. So I photograph people in their homes. I don't pose them. I don't tell them, do this, do that. I tell them, all I want is for you to be with each other, focused on each other, enjoying each other. If you do that, I will move around you. I will move my lights around you. I will, circulate around you to get the pictures that I want to get. But it's all focused on you, and it requires that you be comfortable the entire time that we're doing the shoot. So I meet with people ahead of time. I explain to them, look, if you're ever uncomfortable in any way, you have to tell me, because at that point, already you're thinking about other things and you're being distracted. I don't want you to be distracted. I want you to be totally focused on each other. I give people a chance to get to know me, to find out that I'm not some creepy guy getting off on, watching them while they're doing what they're doing. And I think, I think I'm good at putting people at ease that way because I'm not being creepy. It's not, I've been something of a sex explorer in my life. I've been to lots of parties. I've had plenty of chances to watch other people be in sexual, so I'm not in it for that. I'm in it because if people are being beautiful with each other, are being genuine with each other, I get to make photographs of that. I get to show them, and I tell them, this is the only way you will ever get to see yourself, what you look like when you're in the middle of whatever it is that you do when you're being sexual with each other. I get to give that to them, and, if they're willing, I then get to give that to the world through books and art shows and whatever. Because if we don't have images of people being genuinely sexual, complexly sexual, emotionally sexual with each other, if we don't have those images, then the only images that we have are the fantasy material of pornography, which is fine, but it's not a great portrayal of day-to-day sexuality. If teenagers are learning about sexuality from watching porn, wouldn't it be neat if they could watch or look at pictures that when they looked at these pictures, it would give them some sense of what sex is about, right? Because they're trying to think, what is this sex thing? What is it about? How am I supposed to do it? It would give them some sense of that is likely to make them happy in their lives instead of likely to make them feel insecure and miserable. So that's what I want to do. I photograph people of all ages. I photograph people from 19 to 75, heavy people, thin people, disabled people, whatever, to make the point that you don't have to look a certain way, you don't have to have a certain kind of body, you don't to be a sexually worthwhile, a sexually desirable person. I want people to look at these photos and say, oh, that's like me. And
exactly.
And it's beautiful, and it's hot, and it's sexy, rather than, oh, that's different from me, and if I was 10 years younger, and if I lost 15 pounds, and if my body was shaped differently from what it is, then I would be a sexual person.
And I can tell you, as a sex therapist working with many, many people over the 30-plus years I've been doing this work, there's so many women who have body image issues.
Sure.
And so many.
Yeah.
And so the message is you don't have to be young and beautiful to be sexual.
Right. And men are having body images too now.
Yes.
There's tremendous amounts of money to be made off of making people feel insecure about their sexuality. If people feel insecure, well, they'll do anything. They'll buy products from deodorant to fancy cars to fancy whiskey to make them feel like maybe then I'll be sexual. Well, with a whole culture and a whole economy based on profiting off of people feeling bad about themselves, we're the deck is stacked against us as individual human beings being affected by the world around us. So my goal is to try to put some positive counterbalancing notions out there for people to say, no, you're fine. You can be like this. Look at this. Is this person not beautiful, even though he weighs 200 pounds, you know, even though he's skinny, even though she's fat, whatever it might be?
I had the privilege, along with Brian, my fiancé, we saw you in a photo shoot when you did it up here, I think, a year ago. And the couple was a very heavy woman and a sort of a more regular weight man, and they were having the time of their life, and you were up on your step stool and down on it and moving in close and acting very professional and watchful. And I'm going to guess that a lot of these couples are thrilled to have your results.
Oh, every time. I photographed now 160 couples. I've probably 200 photo shoots altogether, counting people that I photographed more than once. I'd say out of the 160 couples, maybe two or three were less than thrilled with the photos. You know, but everybody, you know, and that's what I offer the couples. You end up with these images of yourself, and you look at them and you say, oh, look at me. I'm beautiful. I'm beautiful
yeah.
when I'm being sexual. There are many, many moving stories. Whenever I shoot film, so the people don't get to see the pictures right away. And when I sit down with all the proof shots to show them, you know, what we got from the shoot, I always try to do it in person, and usually get to do that because I want to see their instantaneous reactions to the pictures, and they're just blown away. And I think the most powerful one maybe for me was I had shot a couple where the woman had polio. She was now in her 50s or about 50, I guess, and she had had polio as a kid. And I don't know if you know about polio, but when you have polio later, usually middle age or so in your life, you go through what they call post-polio, where your body falls apart more, you know. And and she was in the middle of post-polio and had just, after a big struggle, had to admit that she needed to be in a wheelchair and built a ramp up to her, the front door of her house, and all of that. And, you know, it was in the middle of you know, being depressed at this body that was letting her down. But she was also a very sexual person, and she persuaded her husband to do the shoot with me. She was very excited, and he was more reluctant, but he agreed to go along with it. And I took pictures of them, and she told me, she said, this was one of the most important days of my life, because I saw that even in my new body, in this body that was letting me down in all these ways, I was still wonderful, you know. And I tell, when I shoot people, I offer them a certain number of you know, finished prints, kind of in exchange for them being my models. And then above, I don't remember what it was, half a dozen or 10 pictures. If they want more than that, then I give it to them, but I want them to cover the cost that I have of making the prints.
Well, of course.
Well, this couple came back, and they wanted 77 pictures from on their shoot, which would have cost them $1,000, you know, just in my app cost. But the point being that it was so meaningful to them for her to see, you know, I am wonderful right now, even with this body that can't do what it used to be able to do. And this is an extreme example, but I would say the same thing happens for 90% of the couples that I shoot. They look at it and they say, oh, look at us, aren't we something? And every time
healing.
That happens, it's just, you know, it's great. It gives people,
but it is healing, isn't it?
Yes, it definitely is. And I just want, let me just mention, if I can, I'm always looking for new couples to photograph. One of the ways I find new couples is having shows where I get in conversations with people or in radio shows like this. So if anybody listens to this broadcast who is interested in that, or at least talking about the possibility of doing a shoot, I'm always looking for new people to photograph. DavidSteinberg.us is my website. David@davidsteinberg.us is how to reach me with email. On my website, there are dozens of portfolios of photos that I've taken of other couples for people to get an idea of the work that I do. And I'm always delighted to talk to anybody, regardless of your age, your sexual orientation, your sexual inclinations, your body types, your ethnicity, whatever. I want to photograph as broad a range of people as possible.
And I can tell you, listeners, that David Steinberg is the real thing. I've known him for 30 years, and he's honorable, he's honest, he's artistic, he's articulate, he's all those things, and you can trust him. So reach out to him if you have an interest in this, because you may have, you know, the healing experience that this woman with polio had. She looked at her body, being sexual with her partner, and it transformed some of her self-image. Isn't that right?
Absolutely. I think all of our self-images around who we are as sexual people, I think we need all the support we can get. So, I really believe that this is one way of doing it. If people are interested in my new book that you were talking about before, This Thing We Call Sex, it's not a photo book. It's not high quality photos, but we did include one of my couple's photos, at the first page of each of the chapters in the book. So there are 40 photos in this book in addition to the writings, from the times when I was doing my column. So all of that is in there.
Is there? I'm looking at your chapter, Real Sex in Front of a Camera? And you've got Isis and Michael, 2007. By the way, he looks familiar to me. I don't know why. But he is just experiencing so much joy. He's pumping a fist. He's just having the best time.
Yes, this was a couple, I don't know, maybe they were in their 60s, maybe 50s or 60s.
Yeah,
and
maybe 60s.
They were just absolutely, I don't remember how they heard about me. They called me up. They emailed me out of the blue. We heard about you. We want you to come down and photograph us. And we got together and had coffee, which is the first thing I always do with people
of
who
course.
Want to be photographed. And we talked and we joked, and both of them, particularly the guy, Michael's actually not his real name. He didn't want to use his real name, but he was a card. He was funny. He was
He looks it.
and we got together at their house, and they had themselves a grand old time. And I got amazing photos of them.
I can tell. And you have really enjoyed also presenting your photos at the Seattle Erotic Art Festival, and we have enjoyed seeing them over the years. It's been fun. You know, I knew you in the Bay Area, and then you've migrated up here to Seattle and been a really important part of the Seattle Erotic Art Festival.
Seattle has a great erotic sexual community, and I love the Seattle Erotic Art Festival. I've been in it. I've been part of it. I guess they're going on maybe 13 years now, and I think every year I didn't find out about them until I think the second or third year that they were around. But I've been fortunate to have photos accepted into the show every year, and I love putting them up there for people to see, to make the statement that we were talking about before. People look at my photos and they laugh, and I always, I love to stand 20 feet away across the room, watching people looking at my photos. And I think, and when they're laughing, when one points, oh look at this, or they give each other a hug, it makes me feel good. It's like it inspired just a moment of joy for them, and
sure,
that makes it all worthwhile.
Doesn't it, though? I mean, the work that you do is satisfying, it's creative, and it makes a difference.
Yeah, I can't. My friend Barbara Nitke, who is herself a brilliant photographer, I mean, a much more skilled photographer than I will ever be. She has, her niche is that she does a wonderful photography of people in the BDSM community, and she has a brilliant book called Kiss of Fire that I would recommend to anybody that's interested in real photography of people involved in BDSM. And
say the name again. I didn't quite hear it.
Her name is Barbara Nitke.
N-I-T-K-E.
Yeah. And so when I was first starting, I just really hadn't got into the photography. I talked one couple into being my guinea pigs. We had shot some pictures. A couple had seen them and said, "Oh, photograph us." So I had photographed maybe three or four couples, and I went to New York, which is where Barbara lives, and I brought some prints from my photos and nervously showed her what I had to see what she would think of it. And she was great. She just jumped all over my photos, and she said, "Look, David, you have to take this seriously. You can't have this be something you do in your spare time. How often do you find something that is meaningful, that is exciting for you to do, that is creative, and that you can actually make money doing, which I can do because this magazine in Norway publishes a lot of my photos?" And to hear Barbara say, Barbara's one of my idols, and to have her say that to me just like was like, oh.
So affirming.
And then the next, 12 years, 13, 14 years of my life have been consumed with the photography to the extent that I stopped writing my columns and wasn't much focused on that until the last couple of years when I was putting together this thing we call SAX. So.
Yeah,
but it really it's thrilling. Do I get to look at people having wonderful sex, which is heartwarming to begin with, but I'm there and I get to look at them really, really carefully because I'm doing it through the lens of my camera, and I get to have that be the raw material for making some kind of an artistic statement about that, and it really doesn't get much better than that.
Doesn't get much better. The thing I didn't hear a few minutes ago was the name of Barbara Nitke's book. What is her book?
This book that I mentioned is called Kiss of Fire.
Kiss of Fire, okay.
And she has a new, oh God, I'm going to forget what it's called, American, oh damn, I'm 70 years old and I'm forgetting words. Brand new book. Barbara, it's different. Kiss of Fire are these beautifully evocative photos of people involved in various forms of BDSM play. Barbara, I'm sorry, I can't remember. She used to be the still photographer. Her husband, earlier in her life, was a producer of porn films. And she was the still photographer on set. This book is a book of sort of sometimes on stage, but often backstage photos from the porn world that are also really heartwarming and ironic and touching, brilliant photos of the people involved in the porn world. But I got to say the book of hers that is most exciting to me still is Kiss of Fire. It's not one you're going to see in every bookstore in town. But
no,
I know it's on sale at Amazon, and if anybody were to Google it or go to Barbara's website, which is barbaranitke.com, anybody who's interested in really artful BDSM photography should go check it out because she's just amazing.
Yes, and. There is a notion that people involved with BDSM and open relationships have more psychological problems, but actually recent research even has shown that they don't.
Right.
That they need to negotiate things and they need to talk about things. And so they probably have better relationship skills and more self-awareness and more communication skills, a better sense of self, all of that.
Yep. And that's true. Oh, by the way, I have to just say, American Ecstasy is the name of her book.
Okay.
American Ecstasy, The Golden Age of Porn. So I have to say that because I'm terrible.
Ecstasy.
To not remember the name of this also wonderful book which just came out, I think, within the last year. So.
And do you know her a little?
Oh, I know her really well. Yeah,
because she encouraged you. So it sounds like she was a mentor in some ways.
Oh, it was. And she told me, you know, she told me that day we had lunch, and she said she was dreading having lunch with me because she thought, oh, my God, David's going to show me these stupid, you know, he's probably shot some pictures looking down while somebody's giving him a blowjob or something like that.
Yeah.
And I'm going to have to figure out how to say something nice about these photos. And she said she was just dreading getting together with me. And then she looked at the photos and she said, oh, my God, these are really fantastic. So, there are many photographers. I'm not going to go down the hall. Barbara Nicky, Michael Rosen, Paul Dahlquist, Michelle Sirchuk. There are a number of photographers doing brilliant work in this field of that I call fine art sexual photography. Because I represent them all to Cupido, the magazine in Norway, I've become friends with them over the years. And, you know, it's kind of a little community of like-minded souls all bumping up against the prohibitions of the fine art world that is, you know, frightened enough of sexual material that you can do the most brilliant work that you want, but you're not going to get in museums. You're not going to get in, high-end galleries because those places generally are, they may be okay with erotic work, you know, with nice body forms or something like that, but when it comes to actually photographing people in the act of being sexual, well, that's like another step. And that's why we put the book Photosex together, because so many photographers just had nowhere to go with this work.
Cupido, we've discussed this before, but my research on the Japanese male geishas was published in Cupido in about 1992.
Uh-huh.
And so I was featured sitting with some of the the hosts in this wonderful Club I. AI stands for Club Love. And that's a whole other story, but I had a great time researching. Did not do any hands-on research, but I gave the Japanese hosts a questionnaire translated into Japanese that polled very specifically for sexual attitudes and behaviors. Anyway, so that was my connection with Cupido,
uh-huh.
And that was 1992, I think. And so I've been aware of that magazine for a long time now. And they've been exceptional, haven't they, in the world?
Yeah, I think that they're unique. I've been working with them as their photo rep, and they've published, I guess hundreds of my photos at this point, and mm-hmm. some of my writing as well. They're wonderful people to work with, and Norway is fortunate to have an intelligent sex magazine like Cupido. I really don't know of any other magazine comparable. There have been a couple other magazines that kind of came and went quickly, you know, they went bankrupt quickly. Cupido, fortunately, has been here for 30 years and is doing fine. So,
right.
Now, if they have a monthly magazine or bi-monthly magazine now, and they have a website, cupido.no for Norway, but you have to speak Norwegian to be able to make any sense out of that. But for in Scandinavia, they have been extraordinary, and I think they had a big art show there on their 25th anniversary where a number of journalists came together and said, Cupido has changed the erotic culture of Norway, which I think is a testament to how powerful putting out a different sort of imagery, a different sort of written material about sexuality can be for a culture. And I have to say, you know, having sent them hundreds of photos and hundreds of other people's photos from the photographers that I mentioned a little while ago, when all these people were gathered around talking about how important Cupido has been in the cultural history of Norway, is the way one woman came up to me and she says, Cupido magazine has changed the cultural history of Norway, she says, you know, emphasizing with her finger. And I just said, God, you know, Cupido has really done something, and by working with them, I've been a part of that. It was just a wonderful feeling, and I wish we could have as big an impact on the sex cultural history of the United States. I tried to get Cupido to do an English language edition, but they haven't been able or willing to do that. But we need that. We need to bring
right
that.
Right from the beginning, that magazine, I guess the editor happens to be gay, but there were always mostly heterosexual photos, but also gay photos and older people.
Yep.
And younger, it just was wonderful. And I was on the mailing list for a while because of my article being published there. And, of course, people can get the magazine, and if they don't understand Norwegian, they can still appreciate the photographs, right?
Yep, yep, if anybody
knows. I remember at the time our mutual friend Marty Klein, I showed him my article and in Cupido, and he said, oh, yeah, this is a magazine I get for the articles.
right.
Yeah.
Well, it's there. The website is Cupido, C-U-P-I-D-O, like Cupid with an O at the end, .no for Norway.
Yeah,
and
I'm going to check it out.
Anybody who speaks Norwegian can figure it out, and I'm sure it's you don't have to speak Norwegian to figure out how to subscribe to the magazine if anybody is is interested in that. It's not sold anywhere in the United States. Good Vibrations in San Francisco sold it for a while, but it didn't sell very well, I think, because it was in Norwegian. And so it's kind of hard to get a hold of. I wish somebody here in the U.S. would start a comparable magazine.
It'd be great.
It would be great.
David Steinberg, we're coming to the end of this program. I want to remind people to go to your website, davidsteinberg.us, and you can get his book. His most recent book is other books, too, but you'll see his other books. But this most recent book is just fabulous. This thing we call sex, a radically sensible look at sex in America. And if you go to his website, you'll get a signed copy from David. And David, it's always such a pleasure to have you on this program.
Likewise, Diana. It's great talking with you.
Thank you. I'm not hearing the music. I try to end a couple of minutes before because that's what they want me to do.
Right.
But so we can keep talking until I hear the music. I'm looking at your book. Your core message is important for everyone, that sex is a treasure to be celebrated, a path to self-knowledge. And that's Joni Blank, and she's the founder of Good Vibrations. I think that's really true. I mean, we're both older people, and we've had a lot of experience, and isn't it wonderful just to the self-knowledge that comes through sexuality is incredible.
Well, I think it's a very, you know, it's as basic as it gets, and it's a way that we figure out who we are. It's a way that we figure out how to relate in an intimate way to other people. For me, it's been a path. It's been a way that I've defined myself in the course of growing up and getting older. And I think sex and death are about as profound. Sex, birth, and death, say, are about as profound as you can get. So.
Absolutely. And when one, as an older person, when one is being sexual and it's really hot sex, one feels so alive. And as one faces one's mortality, because that happens when we're older, but then to feel so alive with orgasmic energy and relational kinds of energy, oh my God, it doesn't get any better, and it really helps with successful aging.
For health reasons as well.
Yes. So I'm still not hearing the music, but I guess PRN